years. He also has more recently been the founding member of the Center for Urban Growth and Renewal. Together with the ER architects, they are interested in applying a cross-disciplinary approach to research for the creation and renewal of sustainable urban, suburban, and rural environments. Kind of an interesting approach and an interesting work that comes out of this. He's also a core professional at Harvard University's Working Group for Sustainable Cities, and he has won numerous awards, international awards, such as the World Leadership Award for Town Planning, the Daniel Burnham Award from AAPA, the World Habitats Award from the UN Habitat, and several awards of excellence that are more tied to the Canadian context, from the Ontario, from OPPI, from CIP, sorry for all these acronyms, but I'm trying to save some time here. And from the City of Toronto Urban Design Awards. From my perspective, his most interesting award was that he got in 2004, the Jane Jacobs Award for People That Matter. And from their report, they said that he has been recognized for his innovative thinking around the issues of homelessness, home affordability, and the transformation of underutilized urban spaces, and his passion for the historical processes by which Toronto has been shaped. And we're going to hear some of it today. He originally chose architecture as a way of balancing his interest in both art and science, and he believes that architecture is more than simply designing buildings. Very important, I think. The integration and collaboration between planning, engineering, and design are all fundamental components of imagining and building healthy communities. In this process, in his work, he has developed, he has approached the question of affordability from many angles, among them that he developed a prototype for portable house, the Pro Home, which starts as a one-bedroom dwelling that then in stages can evolve into a five-bedroom house. He also has been very interested from very early on in spaces that are underutilized or vacant in urban areas, and he started with a junction between 401 and 427. More recently, he has looked at the Gardner Expressway and the how one can use the space underneath the expressway. He envisioned a plan that would fill the space with outdoor markets, light industry, clubs, restaurants, and artists' loft. And this is very much in the tradition of other international cities. Anybody who has been to Vienna knows exactly what that would look like, or Paris, and so on. So his work is from, you know, from the local to the global, and so I'm trying to stretch here. So on the one hand, he's working on the Union Station precinct plan. On the other hand, he's developing a plan for the Dubai Marina. And then more locally, he is working on the tower renewal, the tower neighborhood renewal, I think an important distinction, to what I already talked about, the Garden Expressway transformation. So why I'm so excited that we have John van Osteren speaking here today is because when I came in the early 1990s to Toronto, I came from Switzerland. I was an architecture critic in Switzerland, and I was just really frustrated over the built environment in Toronto. And you know, you need some time to appreciate a new place and to see things that are interesting and exciting. But also time helps. So right in my neighborhood where I lived, on Main and Kingston Road, a social housing, a mixed senior complex went up in the early, mid-1990s. And I thought, wow, hey, there's architecture in Toronto. You know, not the big name kind of showpiece museum, Galleria, which was at that point in Toronto with the Galleria of Calatrava, which, of course, I like, you know, no criticism against this. But, you know, this everyday life architecture that also should express a little bit more than just bricks and mortar, you know. So, and then later also, Lawrence and Warden, a larger project than the one on Main and Kingston, which was a Salvation Army with church and 157 nonprofit units and other functions of social center. So, and all, both of these examples, the architect was John van Nostrand, and showing us Torontonians that you can integrate everyday life needs such as shelter with higher aims that we learn from architecture, urban planning, and urban design. So with this, John, please.
Well, thank you very much. That's an amazing introduction. Thanks very much, Uta. I'm going to make a little bit of an explanation up front. This is a long lecture that combined three other lectures that I've written over the last few years. And it's probably too long for an hour, and I'll admit to that up front. And I just simply didn't have time to get down and edit it down. So I'm either going to talk really quickly, or I'm just going to stop at sort of halfway or three quarters of the way, or maybe a little combination of both. So we may not get to the end. And I do apologize for that, but I think there's enough in the middle, even that'll be interesting. So the lecture's called The Toronto Pattern, and I hope that the use of that term becomes clear. These are actually, these two photos are a book, a photo from rural Ontario, which I consider a very important book that was written 30 years ago on the landscape of Ontario. It had an essay called The Pattern, which is the pattern. And the other is a perspective of our plan for Seton, the new community of Seton, which I've been working on, unfortunately, for 30 years. But I'm actually doing draft plans of subdivision for the first three neighborhoods now, so I think it'll happen. I think the undertitle will become clear as we move through the lecture. And I start off with a quote from Charles Vincent Blake, who wrote the essay called The Pattern, and I'll just let you read that. It just says we live in a highly controlled country, the English, which I'll talk about in a moment as well. And the other side of that is a quote from Joseph Rickford's The Idea of a Town. So I'm interested, the essay is about patterns essentially, the relationship of sort of planning and theory and practice to what actually gets delivered. Being delivered is what I would refer to as a pattern. So the pattern so far, if we can just take a look at history briefly, I think there are four phases of sort of the development of Ontario, up to 1840. The pre-contact period, that is pre-European contact, which was made much before 1840, but sort of dealing with contact, I would say, contact with pre-existing peoples, First Nations, ran up to about 1840. So I think that's a distinct period. The colonial period, 1790 to 1875, I think 1875 was passing of the Municipal Act, 1790 is, of course, when Governor Simcoe showed up with his grand scheme. And I'd call the unplanned period, so there were kind of ideas and plans in the colonial period, and then we ran into the period 1875 to roughly 1945, where we didn't do any planning, and we certainly didn't do much surveying, and we just lived in this framework which had been set for us. I refer to you to an excellent book, I think probably the most important book on Toronto, called The Unplanned Suburbs, which is a book written by Richard Harris at MAC on that period. I think it's a very important book to read for anybody who's interested in the city. And then we switched to the fully planned period. Somebody woke up and realized, my God, we haven't had enough planning here. 1943 plan launched it, a period which I would say ended with the growth plan of 2005-2006. And I think the growth plan got us into an interesting new period where we abandoned the kind of lessons of the unplanned period, we critiqued the fully planned, and we've got back into a point now where we're looking at both together. So that's kind of the thesis of my talk. I'm in a university, so I have to use that word, thesis. There are some ideas behind it here. So let's just look at that briefly. So that all I can do to, of course, represent pre-contact Ontario is to show the map of treaties that were made by the British with various First Nations to, in fact, clear the land of for settlement. So you can see the complexity of that. You know, one of the most famous would be the Six Nations, of course. The transfer of Mississauga Nation from Toronto to the Grand River is one of the more obvious, one of the more famous ones. But in fact, the whole of Ontario was a series of major treaties and sub-treaties that dislocated Aboriginal peoples, or relocated them, to make way for a new settlement pattern. And that new settlement pattern was captured, I think, most visually in these two diagrams. These were instructions to surveyors of how to survey British North America, as it was called then. We didn't have kind of Upper and Lower Canada. So let me just back this up by saying that very, very quickly, and this could be a whole lecture in itself, but sort of my analysis of what happened after the American Revolution is that, of course, the Brits lost 13 colonies. They lost three quarters of the continent, of the eastern part of the continent, or the contact continent, and holed up in Quebec and had to try and figure out what had gone wrong and how would they keep Canada. And we hear, I think, lots about the tax situation, the Boston Tea Party, the kind of revolution. I think it was all about land. I think they lost control. They realized that they lost control of land. In fact, George Washington was the youngest surveyor in American history. He's a registered surveyor at the age of 13. His father-in-law was his biggest client, the owner of Fairfax County. He was very early on going to the back country, as we called it, up the Susquehanna and into the Virginia, what became Virginia, and subdividing land and selling it to prospective settlers. And the British showed up there at one point, and he was British, of course. I mean, this gets into a whole complex, what's British, and they were both British. But the British from Britain showed up and said, you know, you can't do this. This is a term we know now very well, but nobody knew then. This is Crown land. The Queen owns this land. What do you do? You can't just subdivide and sell this. It belongs to us. He said, no, this. I just fought my way through the bush. This is my land, and it's mine to do with it what it is. That's America. So essentially, that's the essence, I think, of the American Revolution, or a huge... George Washington was, of course, who fought for Britain against France in 1759. By 1776, was fighting against the British as a leader of the American Revolution. And his main army were made up of the people who lived on the plots that he surveyed. His closest compatriots, the people from the back counties. So the British analysis of this under Lord Dorchester, and you know, I have a sort of short-form version of history, and I'm sure there's some historians out there who will critique it, but basically said, you know, what we got to do is get control of land, and the way of getting control of land is to survey it. We'll survey the land from here being Cornwall, which is the edge of the French surveys, to Windsor, and we'll divide it up like this, and we'll hand out the lots one at a time. And that's how we'll control settlement and development, and that's how we'll keep control of Canada. So the biggest surveying job ever done in history of the world, really. People question that in terms of what happened in India 20 years after this, when Simcoe was moved to India. But as I would say, a greenfield survey or a post-contact survey, because it wasn't greenfields at all, there's 1,000 years of settlement, but was guided. So this is what surveyors were told to do. If you're on a river, this is an area 9 miles by 12 miles. Put a town in the middle, surrounded by a common for grazing of animals, but actually a protection from defense-wise from rifle shooting. Small lots for subsistence food for people who lived in the town, and divide the rest up into large farms. If you're not on a body of water, if you're in an inland situation, lay it out like this. The town in the middle, the park lots around the edge, and the farm lots. This is not theory. This is what they were given. And here's a regional plan, if you can, you know, this is a plan done in 1790 for how to sort of do that. So this is the entire north shore of Lake Ontario and the Ottawa River. And you can see Ottawa and the Ottawa River, of course, are the waterfront townships. And along Lake Ontario are sort of a homedown version of those, and then the inland townships. So that's another interesting thing for those who are interested in the plant, you know, the kind of planning history of Ontario. This was the largest regional plan ever done in North America, I can assure you. And the phenomenal thing is it was realized in about a six-year period. It was surveyed out in 6 years from Cornwall, roughly to Windsor. Remember, this is not an open field. This is in thick bush. So people were surveying these townships in the forest, chaining them out, dimensioning them. All the little mistakes that we now live with, you know, the roads that don't meet, and those all came from trying to do that, the imperfectness of it. So there's a kind of famous Tremaine's map of 1862 of what all that looked like by 1862. This is, of course, Huron County and up near Georgian Bay, the kind of overlays of those patterns. The pattern that's so much a part of the lives we don't even know it's there, but it has had a huge governance over our, I would say, not only our cultural life in the sense that it kind of divorced us from landscape, it kind of neutralized the relationship with landscape to just our urban history is very much tied to this. And that just gives you a sense of that's the scenes, that's the kind of territory that these surveyors were working in, and the kind of early pictures of what it was to sort of take a lot and start to settle it. And, you know, just you didn't get a lot outright to own. You got the right to take a lot for 2 years, and you had to build a house 16 by 20, clear 10 acres, and build a fence along the road lines in front of you. And then you were given your deed. So that was a very interesting kind of way of going about things, too. So there's a sort of the first photo laid on of an old farm to give you some sense of where it sort of ended up. So here's the fence that was built, the farmstead, the original 16 by 20 house in the back there. You can still see signs of this today as you drive around Ontario, and they were captured very vividly in rural Ontario, the book I referred to in the beginning. And this gives you a sense of what happened, and here's two farms. So you know that our farms are mostly 200 acres, except in the Irish counties, of course. The Irish counties were in all the bad lands between Peterborough, you know, the kind of highlands behind around Peterborough, where the agriculture was absolutely impossible. But they only gave them 100 acres when they should have given them 400. So, but these are the two 200-acre farms in theory. It's sort of a theoretical drawing just to illustrate what happened. Up until 1850, people just grew wheat. It grew as much wheat as they could. And there was a huge market for wheat. And they were selling the white pines and off to Britain. And, actually, the deeds for people said white pines belonged to the crown. So when you cut down white pine, they automatically went to Britain for the British Navy. But wheat was the main crop. By 1850, the bottom kind of fell out of the wheat market, and also the soils were depleted. So we got into the rotational, same farms were divided up into smaller fields, and crops were rotated one to another so that they could you could keep the volume of production up. And that's pretty much the fragments of that landscape that I grew up in, and is still quite evident today. And that would be... So there's a picture, this is from an atlas, Pickering County Atlas of 1874, which shows that. Note the complete absence of trees. We have many more trees today in our landscape than we had in 1850. Sorry, many more trees than there were in 1900, between 1850 and 1900. The place got virtually denuded, and then it's grown back. But what's grown back is entirely... Well, I'm gonna call it sort of, I call it second nature, but it's sort of man-made nature is what we really live in now because of this situation. And that's the pattern that was captured in that photograph. That's Mount Nemo in the back there and the kind of rolling hills of Halton County. And these are the kinds of, I've just taken a few pictures of the kind of, the generic sort of Southern Ontario or GTA rural landscapes. The rural road, the hedgerows, the hemlock rows that were planted to, after the trees were all cleared and the wind was blowing through your house, you went back and planted these to protect yourself. And so all those kind of elements which are out there all have a kind of explanation in this pattern. And towns, there was definitely an idea about the layout of towns. That's a good idea. The layout of towns, this is a sort of model for it. That would be the town block in the middle. Although only one of these was ever built, really, which is Cornwall, which was the very first one. And it took such a long time to just do this. It took as long to do this as it did to lay out the counties. The surveyor said, heck, we'll come back and do the towns later. But Cornwall got done because it was the first one. And it's an interesting one if you go to it And it was a whole system of squares. And I mean, fragments of it exist in Toronto. I mean, if you took Victoria Square and Clarence Square and the Wellington between them, that's a kind of idea of, that would be transposed here later. So towns tended to grow up much more haphazardly. This happens to be Whitevale, also in Seton, in the Pickering County. And you can see, if I took that picture today, I have taken that picture today, you wouldn't see nothing because you'd be looking at just trees. But that's what it looked like in 1874. So let's just talk about Toronto then. So this is the application of the theoretical model of a waterfront township onto the Toronto site. So the town, the common, and the park lots beyond. It's famous first idea of, and of course, the Ashbridges Marsh, the Spit, which got divided later, and then we call these the islands. They aren't islands at all. They're just part of a presqu'île, we used to call. Almost an island, but not quite an island. And that's the scene of the harbor at the time. And that's somebody standing on the barrier beach at Ashbridges. And there's what really happened. You know, real life is always a little more boring than the theory, the vision. And the first thing that happened were 12 blocks, the ten blocks of East Central Toronto. And then the boundary made here is Queen Street. That was called Lott Street. And urban development was restricted to the south of Queen Street. And between Queen and Bluer were laid out as the park lots, that is the subsistence farms. So from the Humber to the Don were 14 park lots. There's an interesting picture of sort of waterfront in 1804. The British were very determined to keep up a continuous green space along the waterfront. Something I don't know, 200 years later, we're still trying to sort out. It did start with here. And you can see that First Nations residents were still in the area. So there's a kind of, I'm not going to dwell on this, but I did a kind of analysis of these patterns as in terms of, I'll leave a copy of this, and people want to come back to this kind of analytical stuff. So the unplanned pattern, there's what is sort of represented by this. Here's this same plan. The 10 blocks is over here, sorry. And this is all by 1834, what was really happening. So what was really happening is that the town was spreading out in a planners, you know, registered planners, like I say, a piecemeal way. I think piecemeal is terrific, but we're coming back to piecemeal. But a sort of piecemeal growth of the town this way. And you can see already the town lots are beginning to be developed as farms, and they actually became kind of estates very soon after that. But you can see this kind of evolution going on. And this area is kind of characterized by streets that look like that and houses that look like this, which are still very much in evidence. And there's, sorry this is out of focus, but a kind of analysis of one piece of the city over it throughout this period of the, I would say, largely unplanned growth. The farm lots here starting to be developed, housing, you know, being put in individually in each farm lot, and then them being joined together by streets. You know, if you think of, let's say, Carleton or College, Carleton College, or different names because they were different streets that got joined at Yonge to make the continuous College Street that we call now, or Harvard, what's it, Harvard, yeah, Wellesley, Harvard, that whole. You know, the true original streets, of course, were Queen, Bloor, St. Clair, Eglinton, Lawrence. They were the original concession roads. And there's a kind of depiction of that in a built form way. Then you also got sort of people leaving the city and going and creating estates out around the city. And this is, there are many of those. So Yorkville was in fact outside the city at this point. And we see a whole series of estates that are being created in the park lots, first of all, sort of like we do now, only we do it in Creemore. You know, we have a farm in Creemore. Before you had a farm north of Bloor, or north of Queen even. It's the same kind of phenomena. So you had a kind of you know, rural-urban fringe springing up here. And there's a city in 1858, again giving you a sense of this, I hope, sort of unplanned pattern that was growing up, where really land was being developed by individual landowners on a parcel-by-parcel basis, and moved gradually from sort of being farmed to being urban. And there's the pattern you can see springing up. Again, I'll call it the unplanned pattern. There's, you can question the word, but that's the word I like to use. And you can see Queen's Park and Spadina Circle, Queen's Park springing up in the middle of it, just as landmarks. And, you know, Harris, hats off to Harris. This is right off the cover of his book.
It's the other Harris.
Yes, the other Harris. This is a painting by Lauren Harris, but the book is by Richard Harris. Yes, good point. Not related. And actually, Lauren Harris, of course, was a group of seven. His gallery wouldn't show this picture. They said it was too ugly, and it showed a Toronto that wasn't of any interest to anybody. So it's really a picture of Earl's Court, what we call Earl's Court now, which, of course, is, if Andres Draney was in the room, he'd say, oh, Earl's Court, that's a fantastic community. That's one of the, what do we call the community over like Parliament?
Cabbagetown.
When he did come here, he said Cabbagetown was the greatest community we had. And in that little debate in the room, he said, well, it was great because it wasn't planned. And neither was this. So it's a kind of all interesting dimension. And of course, then he kind of entrenched the unplanned pattern into a whole set of new rules and built Cornell, which I think was a really completely wrong direction to be going in. This is a kind of footnote in another whole lecture as well. But that was Earl's Court in 1915. Note the outhouse, you know, this is a street that's developed, and the kind of just mix of people making their own way slightly out, just outside the boundary of the city, so there were no rules. And other paintings of this kind of emerging, informal. It's very much, you know, the last 35 years we've been working in Africa as well as Ontario, and essentially it's very much the same phenomena as a kind of informal settlements that we run into there. Totally different culturally, etc. But just people operating outside of the rules until they're incorporated. There's a photograph of Earl's Court during this period. So at that point, I mean, development meant a landowner getting their land subdivided into smaller lots and selling them off individually. They may be bought by someone who's just can only build a shack, or they may be bought by somebody who wants to build a bigger house, or even small builders who build clusters. So what's interesting about this is that this is exactly the form of development that cities like Amsterdam, Malmö, and the kind of the forward-leading cities in the world, I think, in terms of urban development, are going back to. So you can go to Almere or Eiburg in Holland and actually buy today an individual lot to build your own house on, even though that's one of the most densely... that is the most densely populated city in the world. So this pattern is the unplanned pattern. I think this kind of tells you a bit about that. These are all from the Harris book, so just look at it. I'm not gonna dwell on it, but it's phenomenally interesting book. And then, you know, self-built housing and people who build first a shack and then next a two-story and a three-story, et cetera, et cetera. There's somebody who's started a little shack, built a bigger shack. There's somebody who started a shack and built a big home. They made it. They were working out of Kodak. They probably got promoted to being the floor manager or something, and they built this house. And that house is right here, by the way. This is a street now in Earl's Court. Again, one of the sought-after communities where planning didn't get carried away, let's put it that way, where it can change and grow and is still all those great things of Jane Jacobs, etc. And that shows the fragmentation of the city and the different rules. And again, Reed Harris, he goes into, you know, people trying to, the literati downtown in the core area trying to put rules on limiting these shacks and making sure that whatever did happen, Lauren Harris could paint it and it could be shown in the gallery. And all this driven, too, by industry, which is a very interesting thing, so that we've sought ever since to kind of develop a relationship, live-work relationship, as we call it. But much of this was generated by the construction of places like the Goodyear Tire Plant in South Etobicoke. And South Etobicoke is one of the hotbeds of owner building, of community-based development. And the other, Earl's Court, was related to the Kodak plant up in, down there in Westing.
We're above it.
Yeah, and then that city, the only thing the city did is put a streetcar to both of them. That's all it took. People took that streetcar, and now to work, all those communities along the streetcar developed themselves. Kodak and both Kodak and Goodyear gave their staff allowances to build their houses, which is another interesting phenomenon. And I would say this is the neighborhood I live in, Summerhill Gardens, which is also, I would say, developed in this period. And I think a very interesting kind of mix of old residential and new and some shops. And, of course, the neighbors all now have to get rid of the businesses because they're supposed to be problematic. And then we got to the higher buildings along Yonge Street. So I'm just showing this. There are many, many, many neighborhoods through Riverdale and East York and North York that came out of this period that I think are quite wonderful. And we're now going back to them. But in 1943, a group of people invited Eugene Falluti, who was working on the plan for London at the time, to come to Toronto. And one of the first things they did was a kind of analysis. So this was the state of the city in 1943. And basically the analysis of this from the emerging professional planning profession was that this was a mess. It was a disaster. It was something to get away from. And Falluti produced this plan, which is the first metropolitan plan for Toronto. And it basically said, so all that dotted area is existing development. He said, what you should do is create a green belt, take the Humber River and the Don, link them across sort of a downs view, and then create 7 satellite communities outside of the city, each of which has their own industrial base, will be self-contained. And the most famous of those was Don Mills. The advertising for Don Mills read something like, get away from the go-as-you-grow life of the old city where you didn't know whether the lot next door to you might become a gas station overnight. And come to Don Mills, which would be a place that will never change. We figured life out. Don Mills has some, this is not a put-down of Don Mills, but it did have some very positive aspects to it. We could talk about those, But the overriding idea was it's fully planned. We figured it out. One of the selling points was there were only 3 colors you could paint your house. So you never even had to worry that the house next door to you would change, that somebody painted it purple overnight. They weren't allowed to. They never did. They might still. There might be a revolution up there. So that was the fully planned image of the city, if I may call it, what I would call the fully planned image of 1943. That was a sort of just another rendering of it. This is also the plan. I would say it was the last most effective. This is a plan that's still very much alive in Toronto today. It really drives a lot of decision making today and is a source of a lot of problems, which I'll come to in a moment. So this is the plan that introduced the ring, that is the 427, 401, Don Valley Gardener Ring. Also, of course, something called the Spadina Expressway that got canceled right about there. In 1972, and the Crosstown Expressway, which was supposed to be Bloor Street. If you can see, you can even see the remnants of that. If you go to Bloor Street, we just renovated the central section, but if you go to the outer section of Bloor Street, you'll see freeway lanterns still on there, because when they relit it, they lit it with the same lighting as they have on the Don Valley Parkway, because they assumed it would become a freeway through the city. So many of the, and here are those sort of communities. I'd say the most famous is Don Mills, Central Etobicoke, all the Homesmith were there, North Scarborough, and then North York. One of the first harbingers of the new form of urbanization of those places was this very small 100-acre farm that was subdivided into Etobicoke called Thorncrest Village. If you live out there, get a chance, just go and look at it someday. So they just left the land as it was. They made curvilinear streets and followed a very kind of English, I think it was called, Falluti called it the English Garden City approach to planning. That's Central Etobicoke. So these are all now very familiar patterns. Most of the Greater Toronto Area looks like this. But these are the early versions. And quite successful because actually still the main street of Kingsway at least had houses on it. It wasn't until 15 years later that it reverse lotted and had a wall, say Shepherd, East or West, or Finch, or whatever, that kind of situation. So they were still part of a fabric. Don Mills. Now, Don Mills actually, of course, interestingly enough, is being changed as we speak. So this is the shopping center, which is now going under. Somebody's actually admitted that we could change it, and it's being urbanized, and they're overlaying a pattern of the inner city onto the curvilinear pattern of the kind of 50s. The important thing, though, was there's Don Mills, there's the peanut of Don Mills, there's the place we call a peanut. What it actually did, Don Mills, is gave a pattern for how to take a 400-acre parcel and make it into a town. So between 1954 and 1975, a fairly short period, there were 8 more of those built. And that's called Scarborough now, North Scarborough. But not only here, right across Canada, I have a little booklet from the CMHC published in 1972, which said, when you're planning a city and you want to extend it, here's the pattern to use. And it was this pattern. So it was a kind of mandated pattern, almost, if you wanted to get loans from CMHC. So that kind of, that started also a whole sort of series of layers of development. Then by 1971, with that kind of growth in Scarborough, the lack of transportation, etc., the province in 1971 said, hey, that whole blue area is a mess. That included the old city that I showed first, the suburbs now, which are built out. And they said, we got to get away from that. So let's put a green belt around it. And that's the dark line. It was called the Parkway Belt. Very interesting kind of attempt to combine a green belt with infrastructure and use it as to create green separations between the nasty old city and all the new towns that would spring up around the edge of it, outside of it, North Oakville, North Burlington, et cetera, North Oshawa. Some are still in process. We worked on the Seton plan, which was planned right here. So the government then went out in 1972 and expropriated that whole piece of land and other pieces up here in order to sort of land bank and let this happen. So it's a kind of regional application of the fully planned pattern. That's a look at the Parkway Belt. So that's a kind of summary of that period. And this is, I think, the map that kind of introduced the current period, which I don't know what to call it. If I call it planned and unplanned, because I think what actually happened is that people began to, that there were definitely lessons. So when they abandoned the city pre-1950 and I mean really abandoned it altogether and moved to Don Mills, they did make there was some pretty interesting innovations there. For instance, we had a real shortage of parks downtown. They introduced proper park systems. They introduced, sort of lot systems that were quite interesting. They accommodated the car, which is a bit problematic in the old city. So there were some positive things, but I would say what they left behind a lot of lessons of the old city. I mean, if you take the smart growth principles, which I'm sure most people in the room know, if you look at those principles, they're really all descriptive principles of the city between 1900 and 1950. Transit-oriented, dense, can change over time, you know, all these kind of principles that we now espouse are really lessons we learned from the old city. And it's very interesting, if we go right back to the beginning, the image of this space, this is the image that English had of this territory. Suddenly someone said, no, this is a way to look at the region we live in. So it actually took 150 years for us to say, oh, there's actually nature here. You know, there's actually a thing called the escarpment. There's a thing called the Oak Ridges Moraine. And there are actually a whole bunch of valleys, many of which we buried. And then people started to even dig up those. The whole thing that happened with Garrison Creek or still happens, of that kind of outing old creek beds. So there was a whole new, you know, kind of embracing of nature as well that went along with these kind of lessons learned from old and new that I would say. And I worked on the growth plan, so I would say that they kind of laid the foundation for the growth plan, which I think was a kind of turning point. And these are the kind of maps that started to be done in that period of the middle of the 200s, maps that had never been done before, believe it or not, other than by sort of, you know, quirky field naturalists and quirky geologists or whatever, that sort of showed, my God, we've got a real place here with topography. It isn't all flat, and we have valleys. And then also people started to map the city and just how it had grown over different periods. And I think very important. So what I think one of the main things that happened here is for the first time people didn't just say, it's all bad, put a green belt around it and let's start over. They actually said, let's go back and have a look at it. And this is kind of going back and having a look at it and seeing how the city did grow. And so then you got the green belt, which first version of which was sort of tame and just took the moraine and the escarpment and said, you know, the old city is purple. Inside the old city are kind of growth centers where growth... It's the first plan ever that said 40... It said 40%, but the first plan that ever said there should be more development within the city limits. And it said, as you know, 40% of development should be within the city, and 60% should be outside. We're actually containing it in this white belt, as it's called, and that would start to contain growth over time. So I think this is a very interesting plan, but also a very effective plan, and one that started to address problems, and also acknowledged that there was value in the old city, the unplanned city, the planned parts of the old city, and the unplanned parts of the old city. But we weren't going to stop expansion, and that we couldn't stick your head in the sand and just pretend it wasn't going to happen. And it also went so far as to set densities, which is unheard of a plan at this level. And it also went so far as to make it law, not just let it be an airy-fairy plan that people could challenge. It became the law, and it governs how we grow. That was a later version, of course, when there was a serious... I think it's the largest green belt in the world. I'm not quite sure. That's what the green belt people say. It probably isn't, but it's largest. Is it? Is it? Really? Yeah. Okay. Great. And there's a kind of the refined version of it. And there's a kind of the legend of how to develop in the old city. They started to talk about things called gray fields and brown fields and intensification corridors and intensification nodes, all kinds of things that already within 5 or 6 years we just take for granted now, as that's part of the lexicon of development. And I would say they're about to do a 5-year review of the growth plan. I would be very surprised, well, they won't have the courage to do that, but they should already, they're already discovering that there's more growth going on inside the city boundaries than outside. And already I think that formula is going to go to 50-50 or maybe even 60-40 the other way around with the way things are going. But whether they'll acknowledge that or not, I'm not sure. So it's just, you know, the obvious, these are actually drawings that we did as part of the plan to kind of picture, give density a picture, because it never had a picture before. It was always two-dimensional. It's always the developers that got to interpret it. And we were always surprised. I didn't realize it was an 80-story building, you know. And what zoning is that? Oh, it's loud, you know. So this was trying to say, what do those densities actually look like? So that was what 50 units per hectare looks like. Or go and visit Leaside. It's exactly 50. What is 150? What is 200? What is 400? But even in doing that, it's a sort of implied thing that this could become this, or this could become that, or will become that. So there's a whole implication that, you know, we have to really do two things at once, look at ourselves and where we're living and how do we improve that, and if we really have to, build outside. What could happen to those kind of places, or begin to happen, it already is happening, what could happen to those kind of places, etc. And of course, those kind of places. So, we actually did, at the time, I did a study too. Again, if people are interested in the topic, they could look at this shaping the region. So it started, we looked at this for Neptus, at the different patterns over time, and the various qualities of them, and the success or public cost, private land take versus public cost versus private investment and profit, etc. It's kind of an interesting study, which goes into all this in much more detail. So where's Toronto, where's planning at right now? So Toronto continues to grow. It'll increase to 3 million, from 2.5 million to 3 million by 2030, which is a fair whack. And the Greater Golden Horseshoe will increase from 7.7 to 11.5. I think people are already saying it's probably going to be more than that. Well, Alison Redford thinks it'll be less, but we all think it'll be more. City of Toronto will grow from that. We live in the second fastest growing region in North America. I never know whether to trust these things. Somebody said that. I don't know if I've even ever looked at it. The other one apparently is San Diego is the fastest. Anyway, we're a rapidly growing area. Let's put it that way. If you're studying planning and architecture and all that stuff, stay here because there's going to be a lot of work. There already is a lot of work. And it could even become interesting. So it's definitely not slowing down. And even it's being sort of moving ahead from that plan. We had the big move that came out as a sort of transportation overlay on the regional plan and how transportation would serve the region. So that's a totally unprecedented plan as well for North America to go into this kind of detail over that kind of a region. And we had the growth centers. But here's our official plan. And this is where I think we got some problems. I mean, first of all, this is a colonial document. You know, I only learned this going to Africa and working for 30 years and working in big cities like Kampala and stuff. Basically, what happened is in a British colony, when you built a capital or you declared a capital, you, of course, before you went back to London or Southampton or wherever, you left a plan in place. And it was called the official plan. And local planners or builders were allowed to follow that plan. But if they wanted to vary it, they had to send a letter to London, and somebody had to come out from London and give you an official plan amendment. Because they would be changing the idea they had of the place. Essentially, this is it. This is still our version, which we adhere to, actually. It's remarkable. But it doesn't really say much. The latest one, I don't think. In fact, I'm quite involved right now in looking at... We're involved in revising... I think it's called the official plan. We're in a 5-year period of revision, which is an important exercise, again, for all of you who are involved in planning to be a part of. But notwithstanding, even it's a very general plan. It has some very broad policies. There's nothing wrong with the policies. They just don't land anywhere in any real terms. And the fact is, they're all implemented by something called secondary plans. Sorry, there's a piece of the... And those are the extent of the secondary plans that have been completed. So in other words, we have an official plan that's very broad. We have a fragment of secondary planning done, and the rest is decided by negotiation, typically between developers and planning departments and councillors. So if I'm a developer now, I don't go to the planning department for approval, I go to the councillor. And I get their buy-in, and then I go to the planning department, and the councillor tells the planning department what to do. Or in our case, the mayor, sometimes the mayor even. So I don't think we have a plan. I think we've got a sort of colonial framework which is in place that sort of has had some words put around it. They're kind of, I'm being a bit exaggerating here, but I think you can see the point. The planning, the more detailed planning has not really been done. It's done on a piecemeal basis. In fact, you could call this an unplanned city, in the worst case, not the best case, because I don't think unplanning is actually getting us very far now in the way it did before. And I think that these extraordinary maps reflect this. These are the Holchansky maps, who, of course, as you know, or you should know, he mapped the incomes of the city. This is 1970. So basically, just take it that blue is poor, red is rich, and yellow is middle class. So that was the map of the city in 1970, predominantly middle class, with sort of the standard kind of rich and lower class neighborhoods. And that's the city in 2005. So it's gone rich, much poorer, and no middle class. This is fact. This is not some kind of left-wing analysis of the city. This is what happened. I think I've done it here, I just can't remember. So Holchansky talks about three cities, really. You've got one that's rich, one that's poor, and one that's either getting richer or getting poorer, and predominantly getting poorer. So that's the kind of situation we're in. And the amazing thing is, there is the election, the votes for Rob Ford of the last election. So let's just, if you can hang on to that, so let's go back to that map, right? So the planned areas are the dark areas there, the fully planned areas. The Rob Ford vote is in that area because that's where the poverty is. So whatever one thinks about Rob Ford, and we all can have our thoughts about him individually, he, for better or for worse, in my books, represents the red area. He's a voice for them. And that's our current crisis in the city. Is we've spent, I think we've invested $15 billion down here in the last 10 years. The art gallery, the waterfront, you know, all the new social facilities. We've invested $150 north of 401. So that's the kind of city we're living in. That, to me, is a poorly, that is an unplanned city in the worst way. That's a city that's really in crisis, and it comes out in, so around things like the subway and the streetcar, or what to do with the Portlands, but really it's about two cities struggling against each other and struggling to find some answers, I think. And that's a mega challenge. So we actually have gave some thought to what would a new pattern be? What would the characteristics of this new pattern? And hence we go back to pattern. How's my time here? I should try and. You want to talk?
Maybe 10 more minutes.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. So I sort of think about, and I've actually thought more since this lecture, but about. So what should we really be doing? And it struck me. Not me, but other people are thinking about it as well. That, you know, we need a new pattern. We're in stage 5 now, I guess. And these would be some of the kind of principles of that pattern. So one is it would work with nature and improve our greenlands. What does that mean? Well, I think one of the things it means is we've got an extensive valley system which we don't actually even use. In fact, I live in a valley that we live in the house my wife grew up in, was born in. She played in the valley all the time. Our kids played a little bit as long as we were with them. Our grandchildren can't go near it. It's a dangerous place. Unless you carry a big dog. And there's 5 of you, or you're running in the morning quickly. Because otherwise you're going to run into some homeless people, or you don't know who. You know, so it's become a... So here we are, we're defined by these valleys, but we're imprisoned by them. They're not part of our everyday life. I think we need to really look at that. At the same time, there's been a whole proliferation of urban agriculture and new uses of green space in the city. So somehow in there, there's some kind of new way of looking at the nature in the city and looking at it in a citywide way. These are all kind of citywide principles. 2 is we need to sort of civilize infrastructure. So we've had the era of the Don Valley and the Gardner and the 401 and the 427 and the Allen. And actually, those are already being looked at themselves. There's some really interesting work that's gone on in the Gardner, about sort of civilizing the Gardner. We spent the last 2 years looking at the Don Valley, a little piece from 401 to Eglinton, turning it back into a normal street. All that, you can sort of get fragments of what I mean by civilizing infrastructure going on, taking major roads like Eglinton and calling them avenues and starting to look at how you put trees and bicycle paths along them. And also, a kind of renewed interest in public space. And all you have to do is read Spacing magazine any month and see what that renewal is. And a very popular magazine on top of it. Then I think the third principle is that we actually, it's possible, rather than just let it happen, it's now possible to look back and say, you know what, the best city is the one that changed and could grow. It wasn't the one that stayed fixed. In fact, if we really go to Don Mills and look at what happened, E.P. Taylor, who developed Don Mills, bent over backwards to make sure it could encompass the whole range of income groups. Because it had industries around it, he wanted to make sure the people who worked in the industries could live there. He just couldn't work it out. He couldn't get it to work to have the look it did and balance that. So Don Mills was affordable to a third of the population only. And a third moved up there. And it was 6 miles out of the city. In the next 10 years after Don Mills, we built Thorncrest Park, because that's where all the other people lived that worked in the factories and ran the kind of businesses. So that whole polarization between I'm in the top third in a single family or I'm renting and I'm in a tall building started in 1965. We're still living with that. And I think part of that is that those were fixed answers. I'm not suggesting we all could live in shacks and upgrade, but we have to find the modern kind of equivalent of that, where I can start in one place but know that I can grow it and make a life there over time and change. And that means parts of the city got to change, and we can actually plan for change and encourage change. which shouldn't mean more rules, like Andrew Strainey would say. It should be less rules, but really good rules. Rules that are really simple, that you understand. You don't have to go to the fucking OMB to have them interpreted by a lawyer and pay thousands of dollars. You know what they are, and when your neighbor breaks them, you tell them, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to do that. Or, we like chickens, you can have chickens in our neighborhood. That's not a decision that's made by City Hall, whether I can have chickens or not. I can sort that out. We can sort that out in this room. So I think we need kind of less rules and rules that people interpret themselves. And I think we need to look at these kind of examples of Holland and Hafen City, Malmö, now which are actually encouraging self-construction, small-scale construction, in addition to developer construction. Because developer construction, I just did an exercise this week. I asked a demographer, what the railway lands and the whole waterfront of Toronto, we're actually been hired to do the planning for the Portland. So I said, before we start this, who is that all that gear? What's the income spectrum that accommodates? It's the top 37%. It's the same as Don Mills. So what happened about the other 63? You know, that's the question I think that we have to ask. And that has something to do with this. I think mixed uses, I'm not going to go to that one. That's just no-brainer, and that's sort of smart growth and all that other kind of thing. But I think then we also have to look at sort of overarching rules about being able to figure out new ways of layering on top of layering things over each other. We're already even seeing the condos downtown sort of hover above buildings and all that stuff. But there's a how do we make, you know, develop cities, existing parties, add great numbers to existing parts of the city without destroying the old. And there's a very interesting plan for New York that's doing this right now called Plan NYC. Well, you might take it contentious, but they're actually adding 1 million units to Manhattan. But the two rules are, you'll be within 10 minutes of a park, and you'll be within 10 minutes of transit. That's the only thing they're doing. And that will green, is already greening New York. What's that elevated park is already the first, like, greening now at roofs and Central Park and the whole city's the High Line. So those are all, and then of course, good design. Make it happen, I think, is what's before us all now. I think I'll just stop there. That's about halfway.
Thank you very much, John, for this fantastic talk. Certainly lots to discuss about questions or comments for the audience, and if you have the light.
You talked a little bit about Seton and how it was appropriated by the government in 1972. Mm-hmm. How have the plans for Seton changed from what your conceptions were of good planning were in the 1970s compared to what you're doing now in 2012?
Right. Question is, how has Seton changed as a kind of litmus of the situation between 1972 and now? Well, it's interesting. I went there as a student. I got hired for 2 weeks to work for the province on it in 74. They had a firm called Llewellyn Davies Weeks working on it from England. When I asked, you know, why were the English, I was told in 1974 that, well, Canadians don't know how to plan new towns, which may or may not be true. I kind of made me a bit worried. The next summer I went to their current project, that was Llewellyn Davies Weeks project, at a place called Milton Keynes. Has anybody ever been to Milton Keynes? What did you think? I mean, it's... It was certainly in that period. I'm sure it's, real life has taken over and probably proved it. But it was a pretty disastrous place. And I came back with photos and things, and I told my superiors, I said, "Have you actually seen what they're doing?" Because we had exactly the same plan. It was a 1 kilometer grid, and you know, one of the great things at Milton Keynes when I was there, it was the summer of '75, I suppose. The pub owners were really pissed off because they didn't know where to put a pub. Because the traffic was all on these green roads around the communities where all the people, you know, where all the action was. If you put it in the community, it was going to die, but there was no space on the road to put it. So it was a new town that you couldn't have a pub in England. I mean, what could be worse? What a big mistake. So it started there, and I kind of said to my, it actually led to my being fired, but not for a few more years, because I went eventually to Darcy McHugh, who was a deputy minister at the time, and said, these guys aren't listening. I said, if you've been to Milton Keynes and see what these guys are going to do to us. So then it went into on hold. The province just put it on hold for... And then there was an international competition in 1995, what to do with it, which we happened to win with a team. And then it went on hold again. And then it came back with the growth plan. And when the growth plan work was being done, somebody said, hey, we got to go back to Seton. And actually, what a flip. You know, we got the job to do the plan, which is a development plan for Seton. And so that plan is, first of all, the first thing it said is the third of the site should remain in permanent agriculture, which is fairly radical. There hasn't been a plan around. And that actually, that third is inside the city, not... It's on the inner side of Seton, not the outside. So it actually includes chunks of northwest, northeast Scarborough. So there's a whole area that will remain permanent in agriculture, urban agriculture, I think, or near urban agriculture. And then the urban area is planned for now 70,000 people, but actually it's planned to grow to 120 over time. Assuming that's probably what will happen. Or at least it gives the next generation the choice to say, we're going to build another one outside, or we're going to densify this one. So I think that's another really interesting byproduct of the growth plan, which really doesn't get acknowledged, but you should be saying every time you design a new greenfields place, how can I intensify it in future? When somebody says, you know, it's got to be 80% of our growth has to be in the urban envelope. So that really forces you. It's easy to say downtown, you know, we're going to densify and we're going to put around, we're going to do this and that, but it's really hard. It really hasn't hit the greenfields crowd yet that's going to be dense too, and you're actually going to create a place not that can't grow, but a place that can grow. So that's just happening out there. So it's sort of a harbinger a bit of that. But even as it gets built out, it'll be 50 units per hectare, which is very low still, but really much higher than traditional last 20 years of greenfields.
The transition from pre-war to post-war may have been a sudden increase in the amount of planning, but it didn't feel like it because to a certain extent they were planning a lot of things that weren't that different from what was done during the unplanned period. I mean, the Garden City concepts are not that different, really, from what was going on before. It was mostly a sort of an aesthetic component of planning. It seems to me that the more recent period, which I wouldn't say was from 2005, but more or less in 2000, when they started working on the Toronto official plan, became a more... That wasn't a return to a mixture of unplanned and planned. That was the real beginning of the planned period, where it became theoretical approach to planning and intensification, smart growth, and all these things. I would say only since the last couple of years, since about 2010, has there been any criticism amongst planners of the concept of intensification or of some of the avenue concepts. And maybe now we are actually returning to some mixture of either planned and unplanned, or at least of aesthetic planning with theoretical planning. So I hope that we can find some alternative to intensification as a theoretical concept, because it doesn't, I mean, what you're doing in Seton may be a good idea, but intensification not necessarily a good idea for downtown Toronto. I think they're suddenly finally starting to realize that the theoretical concepts of smart growth are not the answer. It's sort of creeping in there. The harmonized bylaw was a mess, but oddly enough, it contains some restrictions on the attributes. I'm really impressed by that. Somehow right. Creeping.
A child of Summerhill Gardens. You're right. I think the concentration of intensification down here, the kind of misnomer. Well, this, it's very complicated, but I don't disagree that you can read things that way. I mean, you could read the whole condo movement downtown as intense as being a child of a misallocation of intensification and a and the fact that it's now displacing employment and retail areas and that the traffic is equal going up and down the Gardner in the morning, up and down the Don Valley, because people who've moved down here to live now have to work out there. Those are all kind of signs that intensification downtown may be difficult, but I think intensification in these areas will have meaning. I mean, I think the tower renewal is a kind of thin edge of an idea to kind of look more carefully at areas that were planned to not change, looking at how to change them, which is much more difficult than just assembling land down here and building a taller building, is going to take a bit of time. And I think in that respect, you could say it's only the last couple of years that we're really looking at meaningful forms of intensification. I think you're quite right.
But just an example of the corner of St. Peter and Avenue Road, where
yep.
the buildings were just way too overbearing on the sidewalk.
Yep.
I mean, I hope that's not what happens in the other areas.
Right. Sorry. No, I agree. So there's lots of work to do. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you very much for this question. This was also actually something that was burning on my tongue.
He was a neighbor of mine in some regards.
when you said about, you know, the flipping of the 40-60% were to grow, and certainly there's a lot of criticism that has been arising with the intensification of certain neighborhoods in Toronto. I think it is more fine-grained that the 40-60% would allow to.
Right.
There was a couple more questions, Graham and Roger.
I just had a request. Can you put the final slide of the matrix up? I didn't have a chance to actually.
Oh, the final slide of the matrix.
I'm just curious.
Where was that? I can't remember. Oh no, that's the rest of it. Isn't it the rest? That, by the way, sorry. I can't resist. That's the New York plan? What New York will look like. But I'll leave, I just leave this, by the way, for you to look at later. But. There.
This is actually fantastic, and the presentation I heard when you could go in more into detail, so it's very interesting. A lecture in itself, I think.
Yeah, and it's far too simple, but it just tries to talk about how the various elements have flipped over time.
So we will get access to this.
Yeah,
maybe,
I'll just leave
some
it.
Some of you who are taking my class, we can discuss this. Roger?
Yeah, on the density issue, that's not why I wanted to speak, but I just want to point out, we have a colleague here from Paris, Anastasia Touati over here, who is working on this. We just had a session at a conference in New York on the weekend, where she and colleagues from France and also colleagues here, like you probably know Pierre Fillion here at Waterloo, but talking about comparative ideas about densification in French and Canadian suburbs, very interesting.
Yeah.
We talked about some of those issues that we were just discussing, but maybe later she wants to actually say something about that. But I wanted to ask you two questions. I put you on the spot now. And there are a couple of questions. One is a general sort of a comment from you. I understand the chicken idea, but the fact that we have no chickens has something to do with that 100 years ago we created something called the hygienic city. We had sewers, and we don't dump our stuff in the Ashbridges Bay anymore. And there were reasons for that, because a lot of people got very sick from a lot of things. So I'd like you to comment how you'd reconcile the call for openness with a call for hygiene. And that gets me to my second question. A lot of, and like in Hong Kong, for example, now they've banned chickens because of the avian flu. Right?
Yeah.
There are reasons for why we do this.
Yeah.
And it's not an aesthetic question alone, even though it could also often be used with a pretext of making it an aesthetic thing. The second question is related to that, which is, when I first came here more than 20 years ago, one of the first books I read about Toronto was John Sewell's book, which deals with a lot of the topics that you're raising. And John, in his book, John Sewell, criticizes the Faludi plan.
Yeah.
And but the images he criticizes that plan with are also basically images of an Anglo-Canadian downtowner who John Sewell is. So he plays one idea of Englishness out against another idea of Europeanness. And I always found that rather strange. So the question is, in a city which is now majority immigrant and very globalized, and there are a number of students here, we're in a course together right now called Global Cities.
Yeah.
In a globalized city like Toronto, how would that influence the way in which we now need to build cities rather than recycling yet another Milton Keynes, as you point out, or another English or European idea to the nth degree, which will get us just back to what England thought it was going to be?
Yeah. Well, those are two huge questions.
Yeah, you have another 2 hours.
But health. Well, one thing that happens, which is one of the things that always happens when I show, and I haven't shown this very often, but when I showed at City Hall the other day, they said, so it immediately gets characterized as, we don't have any plan, oh, it's all free for all. You know, it's one big sort of semi-planned slum. And I would say that's not the idea. I think the idea is that I'm a strong believer in rules, but simple rules. I think we should have no more than 3 pages of rules in the city. But hygiene itself is, I believe, a thing that's been taken from us. You know, so of course we understand the history of the city, and it was unhygienic, and we need... I mean, we ourselves, one of the most important things I've ever been involved in is building a better latrine to use in Africa, and how to introduce that into squatter communities and in a way that is really works. But I think we also sort of can use it against ourselves by eliminating, you know, dismissing options because they may be unhygienic. I think that people in a neighborhood should, the beginning of intensification, if we can call that, is people getting together to talk about whether they think chickens are valid in their neighborhood or not. And that discussion will come to a good, I believe will come to is, I don't mean that you should just be allowed individually to start growing chickens. I'm saying you need to get together with your neighbors and talk about whether we'll permit chickens in our neighborhood. And that I believe a better answer will come out of that. And I doubt very much it'll be an unhygienic answer. And then everybody will know about that chicken or those chickens, and they'll be watching them and making sure they aren't hygienic. And not calling the inspector to go in and sneak in at night and arrest the person is what's happening now. So I mean what's happened is not just like we've taken a whole economy away from ourselves as well. Like the unplanned period, this is not to perfect it. It had real problems, but all I'm saying, in 1943, we ignored it completely. We threw it out. And now we're scrabbling back for some lessons in it. And one was, you know, in 1950, 40% of the housing in Toronto was owner-built. 40%. It's now 0.2 of 1%. And the economy that came along with that 40%, the Canadian build-alls, you know, people say, well, that's people don't build today like that. They're all buildings. I mean, I always say, well, yeah, and that's why Home Depot's not grown, which it's grown enormously. That whole sector's grown through the renovation market. Mostly people, I'm quite confident, operating outside of the rules. You know, second apartments that aren't really permitted, and chicken coops and things like that. But it's not just we moved an economy, we moved a culture of decision making in neighborhoods. So now we get together to fight a fucking project rather than get together to discuss whether we want chickens in our neighborhood, or whether we want to order a market in, or whether we really like what's happening with the subway station in the corner. All that's been taken from us. So I think we will not make an unhygienic decision, but we'll make a better decision. And I agree, where is the boundary? Like, should chickens get decided at the neighborhood level, at the community council level, or at the city level? It's definitely below the city. I think a lot of the stuff that goes to the Committee of Adjustment could be decided in neighborhoods, between neighborhoods. And one neighborhood might let it go a bit more, and God forbid, they would be distinct. You know, they'd have a culture because they allowed people to go beyond the back line or something. I don't know what it would be. And sure, there'd be some check up above that. So then the question is, again, I don't mean this in any left-wing way, but I mean it from working in third world cities where, I've largely been in cities that were determined by somebody else, and now the government of Uganda got elected in 68, so they've been making a city within the city. I mean, first of all, they had to get rid of it's a huge legislative regime they inherited. Like, we went to work there in 1987, so it's 20 years after the independence. There have been 20 years of unrest. When the air cleared and they wanted to get back and develop the city, same in Johannesburg, same in any of these, the first thing they had to do is undo the British plan of 68, because it was the legal document. What do you undo it to be, is what you're asking. What do we want? And I think we have to sort of look at undoing it. Sorry, where you found the answers to that were in certain neighborhoods. There are certain signs of it, is all I can say. So I suspect somewhere out in the Junction, somewhere in Leslieville, you know, I don't know where exactly, but there's some answers to that question. You know, I don't mean to be stupid about it, but where's the revolution happening? You know, I think that Le Grand Prairie was really extraordinary. I mean, I got on a plane, went over to see the exhibition of it, which is a competition that Sarkozy had between 10 teams to look at the growth of Paris. And it was like reading a manual of intensification versus non-intensification. And it really showed. I mean, there were people who said Paris should not grow outside the boundaries of Paris. Like, none. Like, 100%. Some said 50-50, and some said 80-20. And it actually showed all these visualizations of all these. And they were, I might say they were all pretty extraordinary schemes. I mean, the fact is there was a winning scheme. It was Antoine Grumbach, I believe, if you could call it, was a winner. He took a scheme from 1850, from Napoleon III, who said, you can't have a capital city if it's not on the ocean. So Paris should extend down the Seine to Le Havre and Rouen. That's what they're working on now. And Antoine said, you know, you can actually get in a train in Paris and go to Le Havre in 45 minutes now. So,
that's faster than to go to New York.
Right.
Do you want to quickly respond or bring yourself into?
Just said that it was very interesting actually, because I'm looking for the policies you have here, because actually in Paris it's very difficult to plan intensification.
Yeah.
Because you have Paris, but you also have the suburbs, and in the suburbs it's actually where you have the very difficulties in implementing intensification. And well, I have to say that you have a very interesting framework. Well, the places to grow is very, very interesting, because right now in Paris you talked about Le Grand Paris,
oui.
But right now there is a political struggle with that actually, because it was introduced by the president of France. But you also have a region, the city region, which is the Île-de-France region,
oui.
And there is its president, and so they are actually now struggling about, well, who has to decide the planning of the region, and so it is a big problem right now, because
yep.
The municipalities right now, they can't do anything, so they don't plan intensification.
Right.
So it's interesting because you have a framework that intends to do that.
Right. So I think, and actually the fact that you're in the room, and this is all, I think another factor in all this is, I read a quote, well, it was about a year ago, but from Mayor Bloomberg. So, you know, mayor of the most chauvinist city in North America, really, who said, you know, we learned about transit from Bogota, we learned about trees from Copenhagen, we learned about bicycles. You know, he named about the lessons they learned from about 25 other cities, but said, but we made it in New York. And I think it's sort of a, like, I'm a great subscriber to the one theory I really like is a by a guy called Ken Frampton. He's going to be here about next Friday, by the way.
Oh, really?
Debating with George Baird. And critical regionalism. And basically he says, you learn all the lessons of the world, or you bring them here from your other country, and you know them all, you work with them, but you make it your own. You know, this is Toronto, and Toronto is this way, and that. What makes, so it's sort of balancing what makes Toronto, Toronto, with what I learned in Paris that's really relevant here, and let's work on it.
What is this topic? Where is it?
Talk to the School of Architecture. There's sort of a debate.
So on Friday, next Friday.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
It's sorry, I probably have the thing.
To you guys, because I think that anybody who has time, please go and see Kenneth Franklin and critical regionalism.
Yeah, here it is. So there's a symposium, and on Friday night, there's just a dialogue between George Baird and Ken Frampton in the Tiff Bell Lightbox. Wow, where else? Yeah. George was already, you know, he's not a man of the people. Anyway, that's where it is.
At what time?
That's at 5:30 to 7. I don't know how open it is, but you can get to the Daniel, you know, the School of Architecture.
Okay. This kind of topic. There was one more question in the room, and then we have to come to a closure because some of the people in this room have another class coming up.
Yeah, just really interesting. I'm a neighbor of John, so we've known each other for a number of years, and I really
you brought all your homies.
I know.
People
from Summerhill Gardens, you know, they just taking over the world.
Your income slide, I hadn't seen that before, and especially the change, and it reminded me there's a slide I saw from the states, and in my area is energy and energy policy, and the states that have more advanced energy policy are where all the Democrat states, and those that aren't are the Republican states. So it's similar blue and red.
Right.
But I just want to come back to the comment about health. I think it's really, because you can get similar maps on health, and I've seen presentations where people talk about a walkability index and how, and they correlated the health of people on a map based on, you know, how much they walk, and if you're in a so there's an interesting one there. But I guess the one thing I want to ask you about was part of the Faculty of Environmental Studies, and we have a sustainable energy initiative, and one of the new programs we're looking to develop is on community energy planning. Mm-hmm. You probably know Partners in Project Green at the airport. Mm-hmm. Guelph, and is that an area field that, have you done much in it, have you very familiar with it, and you think it's got something that take planning and then focus on a particular segment of it, have it obviously integrate up into a larger plan.
Yeah, I think it is clearly an important area. I mean, actually, we've done it in spades in third world settings, because you want to talk about, you know, we do an exercise of if you get a dollar in coins, and you could have water, sanitation, electricity, telecommunications, or cheaper energy, what would you spend your money on? It's always electricity.
Really?
Yeah, because it's income. You make work. You can buy a refrigerator and sell ice. And so those kind of decisions and decisions about infrastructure are made in similar ways. I guess that sort of influence, I think taking issues like that to the community. Actually, Adam Vaughan is doing precisely that in energy in his neighbor, in his riding, where he's taking... developing, you know, cogen and sort of using the old. They were going to close 5 schools,
yeah.
And somebody pointed out, oh, we could use the grounds for sticking, you know,
geothermal
sites to serve. And they worked out those 5 sites would serve the whole community.
Yeah.
So they've actually developed that.
Which window or whereabouts was he looking at?
Well, he's in you know, right like. Help me here, someone, but Dundas down to the waterfront and Spadina West, whatever that riding is. Go and talk to him. He actually got some Ryerson people also to work. They've done their own plans in the neighborhood.
Thank you. Thank you for this fantastic. We certainly learned a lot, and we're looking forward to continue this conversation. The next speaker is also going to be very interesting for everybody in here, and we'll continue this discussion that was opened up today. by Tony Collett from the Spacing Magazine.